Today we want to start talking about the division Deuteromycota. Now with all the previous divisions within the fungi, we said that all of them had the division name ending with mycota, and that their distinguishing characteristics were what?
Ended
in sporangia. Now that's not true with Deuteromycota. That's the one exception. Okay. They do not produce spores at all. Deuteromycota do not produce spores. And so they have no sporing structure. So that's a distinguishing characteristic of the Deuteromycota, is they have no sporing structure. Okay. Any questions about that? So these organisms typically only reproduce asexually. Some examples of some organisms within the Deuteromycota would include athlete's foot and ringworm. Alright. We're probably pretty fortunate that athlete's foot doesn't produce spores, right? Or else we would have it probably all over our entire body, at least most of you on a college campus. It's kind of interesting, on college campuses, one of the most common diseases on college campuses is athlete's foot. Okay. Why is that?
People don't know how to wash their showers.
Okay, it's not so much they don't even know how to wash their showers. You pick it up all over. What happens is athlete's foot, of course, is typically found on the foot. It can be found on other parts of the body. But when it's found on the foot, if you have a roommate that's walking around your apartment with no socks on, okay, just in bare feet, and they even get into the kitchen where it may just be a little bit damp on the floor or into the bathroom, you can pick up the athlete's foot. What happens is a piece of the hyphae break off, and those hyphae are able to survive in kind of moist environments for a short period of time. And if you come along and pick up those hyphae on your feet walking by, then you can get athlete's foot. Okay. It's kind of interesting. I've seen lots of pictures of people with athlete's foot. They'll have it up on their legs and everything. That's really common among college kids, because college kids tend to play footsies with more than one partner. And actually, when they rub their feet on you, you can spread athlete's foot all over your body. Okay, so another risk of those types of behavior, right? Most of you have heard of ringworm before. Again, it's only typically passed through contact. A lot of times animals will have ringworms, such as dogs and so forth. A child may pick it up from a dog, and then if they have contact with other children, they can actually pick it up by close contact or by using the same washcloth or, you know, those types of things. They can pick up ringworm. Another group of organisms that belongs to this group is the fungi in the genus Penicillium, they produce antibiotics, and so that's the first antibiotic that was really discovered was Penicillium. And this is a Penicillium fungus here, and basically it produces this antibiotic that we use even today, and it's a very important antibiotic. We also have a lot of derivatives of the Penicillium, but it is a deuteromycete as well. The Penicillium fungus, this is a dead grasshopper here with Penicillium fungus on it. And its main function is to break down dead decaying organic material, as are many of the funguses. Okay. So Deuteromycota, the difference is they don't have the sporing structures associated with the Deuteromycota. The last group of organisms I want to talk about with the fungi is actually a group that are symbiotic between the fungi and green algae. Most of the lichens are made up of both a fungus and a green algae that are kind of work together. The fungus that's associated typically with lichens are ascomycetes. Okay? Belong to the division Ascomycota. You've probably all seen lichens before. These are lichens on a rock. There's a couple of different species of lichen here on this rock. You'll see them on trees and so forth. They live in very, very harsh environments. And what happens is the green algae, when the sun comes out, they actually photosynthesize. And then they give nutrients to the fungus. The fungus, in turn, kind of protects the green algae and actually helps them to collect more moisture than they normally would, and then give that moisture to the green algae. And so lichens are a symbiotic relationship, mutualistic relationship between the green algae and the funguses. Okay, and they're a fairly well-known group of organisms. You've probably all seen rocks like this before. These are some other lichens here, and also here on the trunk of a tree. Okay. Any questions about the funguses? Now, if you were going to write a dichotomous key for the kingdom fungi, how would you do that? I'm not going to write an entire one, but just if you kind of point out how you would do it.
Maybe produce the spores.
Okay, we could start out with, you could use the sporing structures, right? So you could say, for example, old sporangia present, and old sporangia absent, okay? And then just use the sporing structures. Or you could start out sporing structures, no sporing structures, right? Because one of them, the Deuteromycota, has no sporing structures. So using the sporing structures, you could write a dichotomous key fairly easily for the divisions within the kingdom fungi. All right? Any questions about that? So one of them has O-sporangia, one of them has zygosporangia, one of them has ascosporangia, one of them has basidiosporangia, and one of them has no sporing structure. Okay, and those are the distinguishing characteristics of the fungi, at least as far as we're concerned in this class. All right. Any questions about that? Okay, well, the next kingdom then that we want to talk about is the kingdom plantae, or the plants. Again, notice that we're going to use the term division instead of phylum within the kingdom plantae. Just by way of review, plants, their characteristics, they have eukaryotic cells, they're multi-celled organisms, they are autotrophic and photosynthesize, and they are immobile. Okay. Now, I always get the question at some point, what about something like a Venus flytrap? Are they autotrophic? And the answer is yes, Venus flytraps are autotrophic, but they also can be somewhat heterotrophic as well. Okay? But they're kind of an exception rather than, you know, you look at most plants don't use flies or other insects, right? Most plants are simply autotrophic and photosynthesize. Okay? So, those are some of the characteristics of the kingdom plantae. Now, the first three divisions that we're going to talk about in the kingdom plantae, a couple of them are actually classified as protists in your text. These organisms, there's always been an argument among the scientists as whether or not they should be considered to be true plants. These organisms all live in aquatic environments. Two of them are going to live in marine environments mainly. The other one is going to be mainly found in freshwater environments. And when plants are found in aquatic environments, we'll kind of go over some characteristics here a little bit later, they basically don't have any roots, they don't have any stems, they don't have any leaves. Okay, and so some scientists would argue that, hey, they're not really plants. But the way that we classified organisms, if they're multicelled and eukaryotic and are autotrophic, then they should be considered in the plants. Okay, so the aquatic plants. Another characteristic that we'll find out a little bit later, just kind of a major difference, is aquatic plants all have flagellated sperm, whereas land plants typically have pollen grains, right? They don't have flagellated sperm, and the reason why is flagellated sperm dries out really quickly. Aquatic plants don't need to really worry about that, right? Okay, and so there are quite a few differences between the aquatic plants and the terrestrial plants. So let's first of all talk about the three divisions of aquatic plants, and then we'll talk about the differences between aquatic and terrestrial plants, and then we'll end up talking about the terrestrial plants and transitional groups of plants on the way. Okay. So, and actually before we
before we get going here. We're going to split the plants up into different groups. There's going to be the aquatic group of plants. There's going to be a transitional group of plants. And then there's going to be a what we call the lower vascular plants. And then what we call the gymnosperms and the angiosperms. Okay. So right now we're going to talk about three divisions within the aquatic group of plants. The first of those being the division Rhodophyta. Again, remember that the ending phyta means what? I mentioned this before with the protists. Means plant, okay, it's Latin for plant. So the Rhodophyta, actually what the term means is red plant, okay. Rhodo is red, and so these are sometimes what we call the red algae, right? The red algae. Typically red algae are found in marine environments. There are a couple of species of red algae that are found in terrestrial environments. For example, in the springtime here, when the snow starts to melt, you see kind of this reddish hue on the top of the snow. Have any of you seen that before? That's actually a red algae that's growing there. It's a single-celled red algae. But most of the red algae are found in marine environments. Okay. Now, where would you find them in marine environments? Like, what parts of the ocean would you find these red algae?
Near the top.
Near the top of what?
Top of the water.
Okay, near the top of the water to some extent. Now, they actually have to be attached to some substrate. So with those two characteristics in mind, where would you find them?
Close to the coast.
Yeah, around the edges, right? On the continental shelves. Why can't plants be found deep in deep waters, typically?
The light can't
be done. Yeah, there's no sunlight that reaches there, because you've all experienced this before. When light hits water, it refracts, okay? Or it bends. You've all seen that. If you put a pencil in a fish tank, it looks like the pencil's bent, okay? And so when the light hits a water molecule, it actually bends the light, which decreases the energy of light, so light can't penetrate into deep areas of water, okay? And so typically these organisms are found around kind of the coastal areas, maybe around reefs, maybe on reefs in the ocean. As you can see from this picture, the red algae, there's a good reason why we call them red algae, because they have what? Kind of a reddish tint to them. And really the distinguishing characteristics between the three groups of aquatic plants are the types of chloroplasts they have. Red algae have a little bit different type of chloroplast than the normal, what we call quote unquote normal plants. Most plants are green in color. And why are they green? Yeah, they're reflecting green light. And what's reflecting the green light are the chloroplasts, the parts of the plant that photosynthesize, right, with the thylakoids and everything else. The red algae have chloroplasts. They have thylakoids and everything else, only they use a little bit different wavelength of light. What they're reflecting instead of the green wavelength is the red wavelengths of light. Okay? And so all of the red algae are kind of reddish in color. They actually have to be attached to some substrate. They can't just be floating out free in the water. They tend to die if they get unattached from their base. So they're typically attached to a piling or to a rock or, you know, something like that in the aquatic environment. However, they don't use roots to do this. They use structures that are called rhizoids. Okay. A rhizoid is a root-like organ, okay? So if we have our red algae plant here, it will actually have structures that look like roots that allow them to attach to a rock or something here, okay? However, these structures are not true roots. They're what we call rhizoids. The main difference between a rhizoid and a root is that roots have vascular tissue associated with them. Remember when we talked about the different types of tissue in plants? Vascular tissue was the tissue that moved water and nutrients, remember that? Aquatic plants don't have those, and so technically this is not a true root, because it doesn't move nutrients and water up to the rest of the plant, okay? And so they have something that's called a rhizoid that holds them in place. Now, actually, red algae are of great economic importance to humans. We use red algae quite extensively. Some people and some cultures will actually eat it. It's sometimes what is called seaweed. There's actually two different types of seaweed that have that common name. There's some red algae and some brown algae. But some of the algae that's eaten by people after it's dried out is red algae. Also, in red algae, if you remember when we talked about Monera, the bacteria, we said we grow Monera in a petri dish, and remember there was some gel in that petri dish that provided nutrients for the bacteria, remember that? And that nutrient supportive stuff is what we call agar. And the main nutrient component in agar is red algae, okay? And actually, agar is a chemical substance that's extracted from the red algae. Okay, so we use it to grow bacteria after it's been ground up and so forth, right? Also, you guys eat this, eat pieces of, or substances from red and also brown algae in your food all the time. There's some substances, one of them is called carrageenan. And the other is, I was thinking about now, I lost it in my mind. Okay, anyways, carrageenan, and I'll come up with the other one, the other chemical substance. They get those out of red algae and brown algae, and what they put them in is they put them in a lot of the foods that we eat. If you pick up any bottle of salad dressing, any bottle of, any bucket of ice cream, and you'll find these substances in their labels, okay? So you find them in food sources, and what they do is they actually make the food that you're eating more smooth, have a smoother texture to it, okay? Just let me give you an example. Most of you, if you're like me when I was a college student, if you guys have ice cream in your apartment, it's the cheap stuff, you know, the $3 for a big old tub of ice cream, right? And every once in a while you might splurge and get you some, you know, stuff that's $10 for a little tiny thing of ice cream. All of you have probably eaten ice cream like that before. What's the difference between the really expensive ice cream and the really cheap ice cream? The way they taste. I don't know. None of you have rich, maybe none of you eat the cheap ice cream. If you think about it, one of the major differences is how smooth the ice cream is. If you eat the cheap stuff in the big bucket, it always is kind of gritty and crystally, right?
Yeah.
You eat the really rich stuff and it just kind of slides down the old throat. There's no crystals or anything in it. And that's because of these substances, these red algae and brown algae that they put into the ice cream. And actually that's one of the big differences between the more expensive and the cheaper ice creams. Same thing with like salad dressings, mayonnaise and so forth, they actually have substances from red and brown algae in them that make them really smooth to the taste so that they're not gritty. Okay. Any questions about that? Oh, I know what the other one was. Alginate. So when you get home, look on your labels of your salad dressing and so forth. And you might see both of these substances in the, you know, on the label, or maybe just one of them. The red algae is actually grown commercially in the Orient, in small, shallow waters. They'll actually have these strings laid out kind of in a grid, very similar to the way you would lay out a rows in a farm, you know, plow rows in a farm, and they'll actually grow these red algae and then harvest them. So they are actually grown commercially. Any questions about the red algae? The next division is the division Phaeophyta. The division Phaeophyta are sometimes called the brown algae. Okay. And as you'll see when we look at some of these pictures, The brown algae, they kind of have a brownish green tint to them. Again, they are different from the red algae in the type of photosynthetic pigments that they have. They have photosynthetic pigments or chloroplasts that actually give them that use a different part of the visible light spectrum, and so the part of the light spectrum that's reflected is kind of a greenish brown part of the visible light spectrum. Okay. The phaeophyta are all found in marine environments or in semi-marine environments. So you will typically find quite a few phaeophyta like this one here in intertidal areas. What's an intertidal area, since most of us here are from?
The tide.
Yes, in between high and low tide. So these plants are sometimes covered by water and sometimes not. Right? Okay. You'll also find them below the intertidal areas, but many times. But they're really quite common in the intertidal pools. Many species of them. Probably the best known of the brown algae are the kelp. Many of you have heard of kelp before. On this picture of the kelp, you can actually see the rhizoids here that hold the kelp in place. The brown algae are kind of similar in many ways to the red algae in that they just can't survive by floating around in the ocean. What they need to do is they need to be held to some point or some substrate, a rock, a piling, a piece of coral, you know, some hard structure. They can't just kind of free float through the water typically. And so they need something to be attached to. Again, you can see kind of the photosynthetic pigments give them a brownish, kind of a brownish green coloration. In the kelp, they actually have these little ball-like structures that are filled with air, and that actually allows them to float towards the surface of the water. So you'll find kelp many times in deeper areas than you would normally expect to find aquatic plants because of the light situation. And you can find them in deeper areas because they have this little air bladder that helps to pull them closer to the surface of the water. Does that kind of make sense to everybody? Any questions about that? The brown algae are also have quite a bit of economic importance to humans. We actually use them in our food, carrageenan and alginate, and actually in most foods, the cheaper foods, they don't have typically a mixture of red and brown algae, carrageenan and alginate. Most of it comes from brown algae because what you can do with brown algae is it typically grows very fast, and humans will actually go out and harvest it out of the ocean. Okay. Also, we use ground up green algae, or excuse me, ground up brown algae for in fertilizers, also as nutrients in dog foods and cat foods. Okay. Sometimes kelp in particular can be used, this little air bladder, people will pickle it up and have pickled kelp. I don't know if any of you have ever had pickled kelp before. I've tried it. I'm not a real pickle connoisseur. I don't really like pickles all that much, and it tasted just like any other pickle to me, but you know, I'm not really super excited about pickles anyway. So. Kelp are also very important from an ecological standpoint. Estuaries are where rivers meet the ocean, say for example where the Mississippi runs into the ocean, or the Columbia River in the Northwest runs into the ocean. These estuaries are very important for animals, important areas for animals. And in fact, they're some of the most diverse places in the entire world. And one of the things that they need in order to be diverse are the kelp and the brown algae. They provide a food source for the herbivorous fish and other animals. And they, maybe more importantly, they provide cover for animals. One of the most important things that animals can have is cover for predators. And up in the Columbia, at the mouth of the Columbia River, about 10 years ago, they had animals that were disappearing. Clams, oysters, their fisheries were disappearing. And so they conducted a study to see why they were losing all of their animal species. And the reason why was they had lost their kelp forests, and so there wasn't any cover for these animals, and so they just started to disappear. Predators were able to get to them easier. And so then the question is, why did the kelp forest disappear? And what they found was that there was too high of nitrogen content in the Columbia River water, and that high nitrogen content was actually killing the kelp. Now the reason why there's such high nitrogen content in the, why there was such a high nitrogen content in the Columbia River is because of sewage of humans being dumped into the river, as well as runoff from agricultural fields. Okay. Most people don't know this, but any time that you're around a city that's around a river, you're going to be drinking water that's probably been drunk two or three times before. Okay. Because what happens is they'll treat the sewage a little bit, then they'll dump it back into the river. So when you get down to someplace like New Orleans on the Mississippi River, any of you been to New Orleans before? Yeah. Even before Katrina? It's, the water's brown there, and when it comes out of your tap, it's fairly brown. You drink water out of the tap. So, you know, it's maybe gone through a few other people before it got to you before. I mean, all water is basically recycled, even the water we drink. It's just that it's, most of the water we drink has been filtered either through the atmosphere or through underground aquifers. Okay. Any questions about the brown algae? The last group of aquatic plants that we want to talk about is the division Chlorophyta. The division Chlorophyta are sometimes called the green algae. And green algae are typically found in freshwater environments. Again, they have different photosynthetic pigments. They actually use photosynthetic pigments more similar to that land plants use. In fact, many of them are identical to what land plants use. And again, they are found in freshwater environments, and so that makes them different. Now, one thing that's a little bit different about the green algae versus all of the other plants is some green algae are unicellular, some green algae are multicellular, and so we have both unicellular and multicellular green algae that are found in freshwater environments. Excuse me. This is a single-celled green algae here. We have a lot of green algae in our freshwater aquatic environments around here. In fact, a lot of times, if any of you have walked through aquatic environments, or if you fish and you pick up stuff on your lure, most people call that moss, and technically it's not moss, it's green algae that you're picking up on your fishing lure, or that you're sliding on when you walk across rocks in a stream or something like that. Okay, it's typically green algae. Some green algae are very simple in their form. Those of you that have been in the lab, when you looked at Spirogyra, it was just a simple strand of green algae, right? Same thing is true with this particular green algae here. You know, it's not very complex, it's just kind of a strand of cells. So some of the green algae are quite simple in their structure. Some of them, however, can be fairly complex, like this particular green algae here. Pretty much all of the aquatic plants that you see around here are green algae. This is a more common type of green algae that we have around here, and this is probably the most common type of green algae that I see, anyways, or that I notice around here, because this is the type of green algae that grows in the bottoms of most of our ponds, and so when you're fishing, you know, it gets on your lures and everything else. Green algae. Notice again, their photosynthetic pigments are different, so that they do give off a green tint. They reflect green light, and that makes them different from all of the other aquatic algae. Another characteristic of the green algae is not all green algae have to be attached to some substrate. Many species of green algae can actually just kind of be free-floating. Which makes them different from the red and the brown algae. They need to be attached to some substrate. If you get into lakes in the middle of the summer, around here a lot of times there will be green algal blooms in the lakes, and it will just kind of be floating all over in the lake. Okay. And so any questions about the green algae? Okay, let's take a look at, any question about the the three divisions of aquatic plants. In this table here, what we're doing is we're comparing water and land as habitats for plants. In other words, what are the advantages and disadvantages of living in water versus living on land? And if we look at the availability of water, this one's fairly obvious. Aquatic plants have water that's always close to them. So if you're a green algae and you're living in an aquatic environment, unless that aquatic environment dries out, is water ever a limiting factor? It's not, right? However, if you're a terrestrial plant, if you're living on land, water's found under the land's surface, it evaporates very quickly, and so in most terrestrial plants, not all, but in most terrestrial plants, the most limiting thing for them in order to grow, to be able to grow, is what? Water. Does that make sense? In other words, what limits your lawn's growth? Well, it can be some nutrients, but most of the time it's water, your ability to water your lawn, right? Okay. Same thing is true with your corn. If you have unlimited amounts of water, you can get huge corn and it'll grow very fast. So water is very limiting on to land plants. Minerals. Plants need minerals or nutrients in order to survive, such as nitrogen. In aquatic plants, these minerals are found just floating in the water. They're dispersed in the water, and so the minerals are close to each cell. So that's another reason why aquatic plants do not need roots, is they don't need to have, move nutrients from one place to another. They're just basically found around the entire plant. Whereas land plants, the minerals are found under the land surface, and so they're going to have to evolve some way to get those minerals from under the surface up into the plant itself. Gases. Plants need gases in order to survive. They need both oxygen and carbon dioxide, right? Because plant cells, if you remember, they respire and they also photosynthesize. Well, aquatic plants are actually at a disadvantage when it comes to gases. Gases cannot dissolve in water in as high a concentration as they are in the air. All you need to do to think about this is, can you breathe underwater? No, why?
Drown.
Yeah, you drown. And the reason why you drown is one reason anyways, is there's not enough oxygen in the water for you to be able to survive. Okay? So if you take and pump oxygen into the water, you will never have as high an oxygen concentration in the water as you do in just air. Does that make sense, everybody?
Yeah.
So that's a disadvantage for aquatic plants. Support is another thing that's different in water and on land. Water plants don't need to have any supportive structures. They don't have stems, they don't have roots, they don't have trunks. And the reason why is because the water provides them buoyancy and support. Terrestrial plants, on the other hand, have less support, and so they're going to need to evolve much different mechanisms in order to have supportive structures in the plant. Light. In water and land, light, the aquatic plants are actually at a disadvantage when it comes to light, because when light hits water, again, it bends. We've talked about this before today. Whereas on land, there's more light available to them. And so